The Hoop Heads podcast is brought to you by Head Start Basketball. Be sure to visit our brand new website, www.hoopheadspod.com. You can listen to every episode we've ever recorded. You can subscribe to the new Hoop Heads newsletter. And you can check out the Hoop Heads blog with articles from some of our great coaches that have been guests on the show. Again, www.hoopheadspod.com.
We had about 100 employees, 10,000 teams using our product. It was a great, great learning experience. I tell people all the time, like, listen, don't waste your time getting an MBA. Don't go back to school. Nothing will teach you more than just going and getting your hands dirty in a startup. You'll learn more than you ever could. And yeah, I truthfully think that I didn't learn a damn thing in college, like zero. I probably left Penn stupider than when I got there.
And your jumper was better, though.
The jumper was way better. But I learned everything that I've learned in life through running a company for 8 years. And so we had a good run. I got to meet a lot of really cool people, every major Division I coach and NBA coaches and players. And somehow, some way, I managed to get myself in the room with a lot of really, really cool people and build some relationships. And we ended up finally selling that company last year.
Vasu Kulkarni is the founding partner of Courtside Ventures, the leading venture capital fund focused on early stage sports digital media, fitness and wellness, and esports gaming companies. The $35 million fund is backed by anchor investors Dan Gilbert, who's the founder and chairman of Rock Ventures, Quicken Loans, and the majority owner of the NBA's Cleveland Cavaliers, as well as WPP, the world's leading communication services company. Since launching Courtside Ventures in 2016, Courtside Ventures has invested in over 30 companies that are leading innovation across the sports and gaming industries. Some notable investments include Beam, which was acquired by Microsoft, Rebel, acquired by Salesforce, 100 Thieves, The Athletic, Freeletics, The Drone Racing League, Fan AI, StockX, Players Lounge, LiveLike, and ZenRes, among several others. A lifelong sports fanatic, Vasu previously was the founder and CEO of Crossover, a sports analytics software as a service company that he founded out of his dorm room. The company built affordable data analytics and video search tools for sports teams at all levels. Vasu led the company from its inception in 2009 until its eventual acquisition in 2017 by Stack Sports, a Providence Equity and Genstar Capital-backed software company. Vasu was recognized by Bloomberg as one of America's top 25 entrepreneurs under 25 in 2010, while also appearing in numerous publications discussing the use and future of technology in sports. Vasu is also an avid angel investor, having invested in 25 early-stage companies across consumer products, insurance tech, software as a service, and food and beverage. Vasu played JV basketball for the University of Pennsylvania, where he graduated with a degree in computer engineering and entrepreneurship. He continues to be an avid pickup player and can be found on the basketball courts of New York City 5 days a week. When you're done listening to this episode, head over to iTunes or wherever you listen to the Hoopheads podcast and leave us a 5-star rating and review. Your rating will help a wider audience of coaches, parents, and players find our show. Please enjoy this wildly entertaining episode with Vasu Kulkarni from Courtside Ventures.
Hello and welcome to the Hoopheads podcast. It's Mike Klinzing here with my co-host Jason Sunkel. And tonight we are pleased to welcome the founding partner of Courtside Ventures to the podcast, Vasu Kulkarni. Vasu, welcome.
Thanks for having me, guys.
We're super excited to have you on, kind of talk about all the different experiences that you've had in the game of basketball and in your business life as well. And I thought we would start by going back to your childhood growing up in Los Angeles, and then your family decides after the earthquake that you're going to move to India. So if we pick up the story from there, I think that that's an interesting place to start.
Yeah, but one of my earliest memories as a child actually is about a year and a half prior to the earthquake, maybe even less, was when Michael retired. And then, soon after that, Jordan comes back. And very soon thereafter, or that happens, and then this earthquake hits, and it's just a mess. Our house was probably half a mile from the epicenter. luckily we were not home the day the earthquake hit in Northridge. It was Martin Luther King weekend, and we were visiting my uncle who lives in Irvine. So we were about 80 miles away from the earthquake, but had we been at home that day, you know, who knows what would have happened. When we came back, a lot of our house was destroyed. Where I slept, there was a bookshelf that had fallen onto my bed. And so I don't even know if I'd be here telling you guys the story if we hadn't somehow had a long weekend that weekend and been 80 miles away. But, you know, my parents are working class people. They came from India, the American dream. And then this whole thing happens. Our house gets destroyed. And they say, you know what, it's time to go back home to India where life's a little bit easier. You know, you can be lower middle class in India and you still have a very, very good life compared to here. And so, you know, one day they told me we're moving, packed up our bags and we were gone. And, you know, I landed in this weird country where luckily I speak the language, but as far as culture, I'm not really, I was a traditional American kid, you know, grew up eating cheese pizza and watching sports, and all of that suddenly changed. And I land up in India in 95 when you don't even have a Pizza Hut in India, which is very different from today. If, you know,
were there McDonald's?
There's no McDonald's. There was nothing. It was a very, very different time. Today in India, 20 years later, you go back to any major city and you would feel totally fine. Yeah, obviously everyone looks a little different and the place isn't nearly as clean. But other than that, like, you can get anything that you can get in America in India today, but it was a very different time 20 years ago. And so I had a very tough time adjusting to that new culture, to not getting the food I wanted, to not having basketball to watch all the time. I mean, we would get two NBA games a week at that time. They would both be at 5:30 a.m. India time with the time difference. And you know, you'd have to wake up at 5 a.m. on a school day to watch the game. And inevitably, you know, the school bus would be rolling through right as the fourth quarter was ending, and I wouldn't even get to watch the end of game. So very, very, very frustrating and very different life. But yeah, after 3 years of being there, I think I really started to love it. And, you know, I had my friends, and I always say I was a big fish in a small pond having come from here. I was the weird kid with the American accent, but then I was also one of the few kids that actually knew how to play basketball, and as a result very quickly became one of the best basketball players that there was in my high school and in the club team, and then playing for the state. And as a result, you know, many times I wonder back to if I had stayed here, as you know, with my Indian genetics, would I pretty much have just been a nobody on the courts here as a result, never gotten picked, never gotten on any teams, never made it. And then, you know, either lost my love for the game, or at the very least, never actually have bothered playing. I may have ended up being the spelling bee champion, but you know, basketball may have never been a part of my daily life. If I don't know that, but I often think about it. But being a big fish in a small pond in India, I just sort of was the guy that could play ball. And eventually, I feel like that confidence is what allowed me to just keep playing. And then even when I came here, and went to school at Penn, you know, by my senior year, getting to walk on, play on the JV squad, all of that may never have happened. But then there's the other side of, hey, nobody actually ever taught me how to play the game in India. I just learned how to play watching videos of Jordan, essentially. And had I lived here and had my parents allowed me to train, maybe I actually would have ended up being a significantly better player because I would have actually been coached. So there's both sides of it. I who knows what would have actually ended up happening, but I can't complain. I had a great childhood. I got to live in two very, very different countries, got to see the world, and you know, ended up back here where I get my full fill of basketball on a daily basis.
So how did you learn the game while you were there in India? What did you, with obviously the coaching, as you said, wasn't quite up to the quality that you would have experienced if you had been here. So how did you learn how to play the game while you were there in India?
It was a lot of watching whatever was on TV. When my dad would come back over here on work, we would have our friends record, back then, VHS tapes. It would have been a lot easier today where I could have just had someone dropped me a Dropbox file. But back then, He literally would bring home 20, 30 VHS tapes in his suitcase from business trips here of games that our friends had recorded for me so that I could watch all the games. You know, I already knew what had happened, but that's all we had. And so I'd be watching these old 90s NBA games that had already occurred and sort of that getting my fill of it. And that's really how I learned to play the game. Other than, you know, the coaches in India were great. They were passionate. They tried, but no one had taught them the game the right way either. And so, you know, you would show up to practice and, you know, the first thing you'd do is you'd be on this giant field outdoors because everything there is outdoor. I'd never played in an indoor court until I got to college here. Everything's outdoors. Some of them don't even have asphalt. You're playing on dirt. And like the first thing you do when you got there, they're like, all right, guys, we're going to warm up. You would literally run like 5,000 meters around this field to warm up. And that was what we thought warming up meant. And so it's just such a different world. But, you know, they really tried and they were good people. And again, hats off to every coach that I ever had from middle school all the way up to high school and all the club teams I played on. You know, they with their limited knowledge and their love for the game, they tried their damn best to teach us. And I'm sure they taught us some things. But really, you know, the game that I play today, I think I didn't really learn that until I came here and started playing pickup in college and learned. Like, I don't think anyone taught us to set an off-ball screen one time through my entire time playing in India, which is absurd.
So going back to what you said about your dad bringing you VHS tapes, you could maybe say you were the original NBA Hardwood Classics that NBA TV runs. Now, they should have just taken all those VHSs and just they could run those all the time. What do you think about that?
I'm pretty sure if they found out the NBA would come after us and sue us for having exported videos, copyrighted videos from the U.S. to India.
The legal exportation of leaked property. That's hilarious. So did you always know, even after you moved, that you were going to come back and go to college in the United States?
Yeah, that was a given. I mean, that was, you know, my parents, like most Asian parents, it's a very, you know, set, hey, listen, do your homework. You better be good at math and science. You better be good with computers. And when the time comes and you're 18, your ass is headed to the best university. Like, you're going to an Ivy League school. And that was pretty much from the day I was born, that's what my parents told me. And, you know, part of me is always like, man, Asian parents really need to lighten up. But the other part of me is like, man, like the fact that Asian parents drill that into you from the time you're 5 years old, you grow up just expecting that you're going to go to an Ivy League school, and it works out sometimes. I think the key is making sure that it's a healthy push and it's never to the detriment. Like, my parents never said, while they would always go, oh man, you're always focused on basketball, this and that. They never kept me from playing. And if I hadn't gone into an Ivy League school, I don't think my parents would have yelled at me or been disappointed in me. But it was sort of like this expectation that they always had. And I think that most Indian Asian kids, like, we just feel like we have to live up to those expectations. As long as it's healthy, it's good. But, you know, some parents obviously take that to a whole nother level and it ends up really messing their kids up. But I was very lucky that my parents were very supportive of all the other extracurricular things that I always was into, and I ended up getting into a whole slew of colleges and ended up picking Penn sight unseen. I knew nothing about Penn other than the fact that it was an Ivy League school. I just, you know, basically threw a dart at a wall and picked one of the schools and I showed up. I'd never toured any of these campuses. I didn't do any of the things that kids here would normally do when they're getting ready to pick a college, because let me tell you, if I had gone on a tour of UCLA or UC San Diego's, I probably would have ended up on the beach rather than in freezing Philadelphia, but it all worked out for me.
What was the biggest adjustment coming back from India to college from a social, basketball, academic? What were some of the adjustments that you had to make, or was it not that big of an adjustment because of, you know, growing up in the culture originally?
So I think having grown up in both countries was a huge plus. I think Penn is a very, very diverse school. I mean, my year, I think there were 100 and something kids admitted directly from India, not including Indian Americans, but just straight up kids like me from India. And so, it's such a diverse place that you don't really feel like you've come to another world. But part of me many times felt like I was back in India with the number of Indians that I saw on campus. I think the biggest adjustments for me were academically. You know, Ivy League schools are a whole nother ball game. You grow up your whole life being, again, a big fish in a small pond. When you're in high school, you know, you've got, I've written about this on my blog about how when you're in high school, there's kids from all over that are in your high school. There's the super smart kids. There's the dumb kids. There's the kids that are doing drugs and the kids that are athletes. And you've got just so much diversity. But then when you go to an Ivy League school, all of that changes. All 2,000 kids in your class were all valedictorians. They were all the smartest kids in their class. They were all athletes. And it's crazy when you land up in an environment like that, and all of a sudden you go from your whole life being the man to now looking around you and you're like, yo, I am stupid as shit. Like, every one of these kids is so much smarter than I am. And you go to the basketball court and you've got, like, in pickup games, you've got 7-footers who are just normal kids studying, not even on the team, that are playing pickup with you. And you're like, wow, like, I'm not, no longer am I not even the smartest kid. I'm also now not the best basketball player on campus. And so for me, I think it was sort of a rude awakening, my whole life of having been the best at everything I did, all of a sudden showing up in an environment where I'm nowhere close to being the best at anything. And then, of course, you know, the style of basketball, you know, I just had never seen what games were like here. It was, you know, in India, you're kind of running around like a headless chicken. And so I really took 2 to 3 years, I feel like, to evolve the game and to learn the game and the way it's played here. And sort of made up my mind that freshman year that come what may, I was going to try to make the team. Academics be damned, don't really care, as long as I don't flunk out and they don't send my parents a letter saying that your son has been, you know, has flunked out of Penn. I'm fine with it. I don't care if I'm getting straight C's. Like, my goal was, let's play basketball. And you know, again, it worked out for me. A lot of things had to go right. There were injuries and people not getting their NCAA clearance, and so many things had to go right for this 5'10 Indian kid to get the last spot on that JV team as a senior. But it happened. And you know, some of my friends say that I have the power of attraction, that somehow, some way, whatever I want, I put it out there and it happens for me. And I got real lucky. Like, that year was the best year of my life, getting to play at the Palestra.
Yeah, that had to be very cool. What was the process like for you from the time you set foot on campus to the time that you got offered that final spot on the JV team? Like, what was your process for improving yourself as a basketball player? Were you just playing a ton of pickup? Were you working out from a basketball standpoint, working on your body, nutrition? Like, what did you do to give yourself the best opportunity to be able to make the team?
So, but freshman year, I was 135 pounds soaking wet, skin and bones. You know, I'm a vegetarian who hates vegetables. Like, I'm the most unhealthy.
Now, that's an unusual combination, Vasu.
Exactly. I have the diet of an 8-year-old. I'm like, where's my grilled cheese and fries? And it's not a good thing. But I was really, really weak coming in. And I tried out for JV that freshman year. And I remember going through tryouts thinking I was actually kind of okay. And coach pretty much telling me, first cut, listen, man, you've got a little bit of skill, but there's just no way you can play at a Division I school. Like, there's no chance you're going to make this team. And I remember writing him back and saying, hey, I just want to get better. Like, can I come to practice? Can I just be on the sidelines and watch? And he was one of those coaches that didn't allow that. You know, some coaches I feel like are out there that would have been thrilled to have a kid that was that passionate and would have said, you know what, why don't you come? Why don't you be a manager? Why don't you do something? But I never got that from the coach who was there at that point. And so I couldn't attend practice. So at that point, you just go to the rec center and I would play literally 5 days a week. My routine I would wake up around noon. I would have missed all of my classes in the morning because I'm not going to 8 a.m. engineering.
You got to save some energy for the courts, man.
Yeah, it's not happening. So I would wake up around like 11 or 12, you know, roll out of bed, grab a burrito, eat, go to the gym, get some shots up, wait for everyone else to finish class at like 4 o'clock. Then the 4 o'clock group would roll in and we would play ball from 4:30 till 7 o'clock. And then we'd all roll out, we'd go get dinner, and then most normal kids would go home and study and do homework. Meanwhile, there would be another run from 10 to 1 in the night, and I would go right back to the gym, and we'd play pickup from 10 p.m. to 1 a.m. And when I think about, you know, one, the amount of time I squandered not taking advantage of what an Ivy League campus would give you just to play basketball, it's disgusting. And then when I think about the number of hours I put on my body playing basketball today, I mean, I have no chance even doing two-a-days at this point in my life. I was some days doing three-a-days. But that's the beauty of being 18 years old. And it's funny how quickly the body goes downhill when you hit 30.
Yeah, no, I can relate to that. I'm 48, so I can completely relate. I hit a point where I was playing and then it just got, I had kids and my career went south right after that and just decided it was time to retire.
I'm 32 and I coach middle school basketball, and after playing 4 straight hours with them, I had 2 weeks, I coach both girls and boys, and they don't play at the same time, but there's like a 2 week overlap. At the end of those 4 hours of practices, those 2 weeks, I was toast. I was done.
I don't doubt it. And so, you know, for freshman year, I got cut. Sophomore year, I think I was injured. I forget what happened, but I had a pretty serious injury that kept me from being able to go out there. Junior year, I feel like I was kind of discouraged. And I didn't go out to tryouts at all my junior year and just kept playing pickup. And then finally senior year, I remember some of my friends saying, "Hey man, like it's now or never, you know, this is it. You should go out there and see what happens." And so, you know, I show up for day one of tryouts and I just had one of those days where everything was going right for me. I was putting up shots, not thinking about them. Everything was falling. So I knew coming out of that, I had played well enough that there was no way I was going to get cut on the first day. Now, I didn't know if I was going to make the team, but I knew I would at least get past first cut. I remember a couple days later getting the email from the coach saying, "See you guys at the gym at 4 p.m. If you got this email, you made first cut." And so, you know, again, one of the greatest moments of my life. Remember where I was standing, who I was standing there with, opening that email on my phone and just being ecstatic. And so I go to a couple more sessions, couple more tryouts. People are getting cut. I'm still on the team. And then what happens is, you know, we're probably a week or two away from sort of the season starting. The team's probably been whittled down to like 14-ish people, a 12-man squad. Couple of guys we knew were having some issues with eligibility, and the coach says something to a bunch of us. He goes, "Hey, where's Tim? Isn't he your class, the freshman kid?" And I'm like, "No, he's the freshman. I'm a senior." And the coach looks at me, goes, "You're a senior?" I go, "Yeah." And he goes, "Dude, I can't put a senior on my squad. The whole point of JV is to sort of get kids that have a chance of continuing to evolve and get better and could one day possibly be called up to varsity. And as a senior, there's no point in me having you on the squad because you're obviously not good enough for varsity today. And I thought you had some potential, but it's not going to work out." And you know, it was like my world was coming crashing down. I had gotten to the absolute last part of this whole journey, and this little thing of being a senior was going to kill the dream. And so I went home and I wrote him the coach, this giant email about, you know, telling him my sob story and how this was my dream to play college basketball. And this was my last chance and this was it and blah, blah. And anyway, he was a great guy and he sort of understood. And he said, "Listen, you hustle for the next couple of weeks in practice and you dive after every loose ball and we'll see what happens come game day." And like I said, a lot of things had to fall into place, but a couple of the guys that probably would have taken the spot over me didn't make the squad for various reasons that year. And I pretty much, you know, for the most part, ended up being the last man on that roster that made it. And then, you know, after that, once the season started, yeah, I was probably being put in backup guard playing 15, 17 minutes a game, all home schedule because everybody wants to play at the Palestra. So even when we played St. Joe's twice in a season, both games were home games for us because St. Joe's wanted to play at the Palestra. And so it was a really, really cool year getting to have an all home schedule. And, you know, I had one double digit game, which was, you know, just the pinnacle. And then the end of the season, my parents happened to be in passing through Philadelphia and they got to come watch a game, watch me play at the Palestra and score a couple points. So that was really special.
Yeah, that's awesome. I can just feel the passion that you have for basketball and just the fact that you were willing to sit down and write the letter to the coach and explain just, you know, how hard you worked and how much you love the game. I think that anybody who's a coach, a player that has to have respect for, again, like I said, I can hear it coming through the, you know, coming through my headphones, just how much you love the game of basketball. And so when you get done playing and you start looking around and you want to, I'm assuming that you want to continue to work in sports. So you want to have something to do with the game of basketball if you possibly could. So talk a little bit about how you transitioned from the world of Ivy League basketball at Penn into the quote real world and got out and looked at what are the opportunities that you were out in front of you for sports and business.
Well, you know, necessity is the mother of invention. My 1.9 GPA my senior year was not helping my case in getting a job anywhere. That was for sure. And, you know, I had ignored all of the things that normal people do during college. Like all my peers were busting ass. They were recruiting every semester. They were doing internships. They were going to all these recruiting sessions and kissing ass with Wall Street guys. And I did none of that. Like all I wanted to do was hoop. And so, you know, senior year comes, I finished playing and now shit's about to get real because I don't have any money. And I'm about to get thrown out into the real world. And so, you know, I applied to a couple jobs. Somehow I actually had two job offers, which is absolutely ridiculous that anyone would hire me.
Well, you went to Penn. A 1.9 at Penn is probably, you know, equivalent to a 3.5 somewhere else. So we'll give you a little credit.
That may be the only reason I got a job is someone may have done that translation that you just did and decided maybe this kid's not a complete idiot. But I had these two jobs. One was a sales job offer and one was a consulting job offer. And I kind of knew going into this thing that, yeah, I was not a 9-to-5 guy. I was always meant to be an entrepreneur. And I had already started thinking about building something within sports and basketball and tech. And I didn't know exactly what it was going to be, but I knew, you know, sports data and analytics were important and they were kind of underserved in the sports market. And so I'd already started thinking about this, but I needed to earn some money to pay my bills and had student loans and whatnot. And so I ended up taking the consulting job, which ended up being, you know, just a huge blessing because if I'd taken the sales job, you know, you got to be out there grinding. And it's very easy to tell when you're not doing your job in a sales job because the numbers aren't there. Your ass is getting canned. But in a consulting job, if you're not really doing anything, nobody really
knows. It's a little fuzzier.
It's very, very fuzzy. And somehow for 18 months, I was gainfully employed doing absolutely nothing. It was 2009.
You mean you're playing basketball.
You were playing basketball during that time, I'm assuming.
I was playing ball, but I was also getting crossover off the ground. And yeah, I never could have done that if I didn't have sort of someone paying me a salary as I was able to spend my hours every day working on this startup. And so eventually, you know, 18 months in, I quit my job. We raised a little bit of money and we'd sort of come up with this idea of taking game film from coaches, having it broken down again, all by humans. There was no secret sauce here. People thought we had taught a computer how to break down high school basketball games. And that, even today, that's not possible 10 years later. But we basically had just said, you know what, this is a data entry job. We'll find a way to essentially outsource the whole process of indexing a video, tagging, hey, player number 4 just took a shot from 17 feet and missed it, and player number five on this team got the rebound, and basically just tagging and tracking everything that happens in a game off of the video feed and giving that information back to the coaches. And we didn't know if it was going to work. And we certainly had many, many rough times over the years. A lot of things went wrong, but we put together a hell of a team here in New York, and for 8 years grew that business. We had about 100 employees, 10,000 teams using our product. It was a great, great learning experience. I tell people all the time, like, listen, don't waste your time getting an MBA. Don't go back to school. Nothing will teach you more than just going and getting your hands dirty in a startup. You'll learn more than you ever could. And yeah, I truthfully think that I didn't learn a damn thing in college, like zero. I probably left Penn stupider than when I got there.
And I learned your jumper was better though.
The jumper was way better. But I learned everything that I've learned in life through running a company for 8 years. And so we had a good run. I got to meet a lot of really cool people, every major Division I coach and NBA coaches and players. And somehow, some way, I managed to get myself in the room with a lot of really, really cool people and build some relationships. And we ended up finally selling that company last year to a group down in Dallas. And then through my time running the company, I had built relationships with a lot of NBA team owners. One in particular, Dan Gilbert from Cavs, was a big investor in my company. And we sort of got together and decided to do this venture thing together. A couple of years ago, we felt like there were no early stage venture funds out there that were investing in sports related businesses, and rightly so. I mean, it's a tough space to invest and make real big returns. But we felt like, when I was getting started, I could not raise money from any venture funds anywhere. No one would back us. We ended up having to kind of go find individual Wall Street guys, and I took checks as small as $5,000 and guys wrote $10,000, $25,000, $50,000 checks, and we kind of cobbled everything together until I met guys like Dan that could write big checks. But we felt like somebody's got to provide capital to early stage founders in this space. And so we set up a fund specifically to do that. And it's gone pretty well. We've over the last 3 years, we've made 35 investments in companies that are in some way related to sports or esports, which is the new flavor of the week. That was something that I didn't know anything about going into this 3 years ago. And esports and gaming was just starting to become a mainstream word. And now 3 years later, it's unbelievable. I mean, there's kids making $10, $20 million a year. They're 16-year-old playing video games from their mom's basement. And so that whole world is something that we're very fascinated by, and we're all in on it. We actually started our own team, and we've made a number of investments in that space as well.
Registration is now open at www.headstartbasketball.com for this summer's Head Start Basketball Camps. We'll be hosting camps this summer in Strongsville, Westlake, Avon Lake, Oberlin, Brunswick, Highland Heights, Mentor, and Hudson. At Head Start Basketball, we care deeply about making a positive impact on the lives of young basketball players, both on and off the court. It's through building strong relationships with our players, parents, and coaching staff that we are able to use the game of basketball to enrich the lives of those we interact with, both inside and outside of our organization. We believe that our attention to detail, our growth mindset, and our commitment to lifelong learning allows us to help our players achieve their fullest potential. We are passionately committed to providing players, parents, and coaches with everything they need to reach their goals. These core values run through everything we do. Check out our website, www.headstartbasketball.com, and discover why you should attend a Head Start Basketball Camp this summer. Hope to see you there.
So let's jump back to, first of all, how you got in contact and met Dan Gilbert and how that relationship got started first. And then after you explain that, I want to jump back to talking a little bit about why you think esports and the gaming and all that, why you think it's the direction that, is much more popular than I think people our age necessarily might think it is. So can you talk a little bit about the Gilbert piece first, and then we'll jump back to the esports?
Yeah, so this was 2013. We had been running the business for almost, 3 years at this point. I was not having a lot of luck raising big dogs. I'd raised a couple million dollars, but in very, very small checks. And so when you don't get a big chunk at any given time, you can't really grow. You're sort of keeping the lights on. And we had finally reached a point in 2013, I feel like, where I was getting worried that if we couldn't raise real money, I didn't think that this was a business that we could grow big enough. And as a result, we had actually started to completely pivot our strategy away from the actual product of crossover selling to coaches. And we had started building a mobile game because we just felt like, hey, a mobile game is something people will invest in. Let's start building this thing out. It was still sports related, but it was a game. It was completely different from our original idea. And so sort of as a last ditch effort, I went to All-Star Weekend 2013 in Houston. Through some people I had gotten to know that, you know, Dan's a big technology guy and that he's somebody that I should try to get in front of. And so I go down there, I snuck into this thing called the NBA Tech Summit, which is probably my second or third year sneaking in. It's probably the most exclusive technology summit that there is. They do it every year at NBA All-Star Weekend. It's Friday before the festivities begin. It's that morning at 8 a.m. and it's the who's who of the NBA world and the who's who of the tech world. And they had Twitter CEO up there, Yahoo CEO. They have unbelievable demos of the latest technology. It's a really cool half day conference. And so I knew Dan was going to be there. I stole someone's badge. I got myself in and I go up to him right before he's about to speak on stage. And I just introduced myself. Told him what I do, and he goes, oh, you know, I really love your product. My son's team in Detroit uses it for their high school. And I go, oh, wow, that's great. That's helpful. I didn't think you had any idea what the hell this thing was. And so yeah, he says, yeah, let's get together after. So the next day, you know, I waited all day for him, and finally at 7 p.m. he comes down, and we got a drink, and we chatted for a couple hours, and the guy he believed in what we were doing. And, you know, when nobody else would give us money, Dan stepped up and he was willing to write us a pretty sizable check at that stage. And then, you know, from there, got to meet a bunch of other NFL and NBA owners, and many of them ended up investing in the company over the course of years. And you know, the rest is history. And so I always tell people, like, that day in 2013 really changed the course of my life forever when I met Dan, because if I just somehow hadn't gotten that meeting to happen, I don't know if we would have kept running this company. I think we would have completely pivoted. And listen, maybe we would have been a $1 billion gaming company now, but there's also a chance we would have completely gone under and, you know, I'd be doing something completely different. And instead, you know, got through the company, got to run a fund, and probably going to keep doing this for the foreseeable future.
How difficult was it to sell after you had started it and been the CEO and you kind of grew it from nothing and you got through these difficult times? How difficult was it when you had to eventually make that decision to not continue on? How hard was that?
Yeah, I'd say that ranked up there as probably the toughest day in my life, even though, you know, financially it's, you know, the biggest, I never had that much money in my bank account ever. And so there's that part of, okay, we're getting paid and that's awesome. But in terms of having to let all of that go, it was probably one of the worst days of my life, having to go up and, cause you can't tell your employees before it's all done. Because these things, you know, they fall apart in the 11th hour all the time. I, to be perfectly honest, the day that we signed the papers, I did not know if this deal was 100% going to go through. I thought there was a chance that someone could pull out here and something could happen. And you can't let all your employees think that something's happening and then all of a sudden it doesn't happen. And then they're like, well, what's wrong with this company? Why did the whole deal fall apart? And so there was only a very small group of my core management team that was in the loop and knew what was happening. And then having to go up and stand in front of 100 people and let them know, hey, listen, you know, the ride's kind of over, guys. Like, this thing's being sold. And as much as you want to put a positive spin on it and say things are going to be fine and things are going to be the same, don't worry. Like, you know, in the pit of your stomach that this nothing's ever going to be the same again, especially when you're selling the company to private equity guys whose job is to come in and basically cut costs and dismantle and run this thing for profit and do things the exact opposite way that I had done things for 8 years. So it really sucked for that to be in an ideal world. I would have loved to have done this forever. And I think that most of the people who worked for us would tell you the same thing, that it's the best job they ever had. But you know, that's what happens when you raise money and you have investors that one day need to make a return. And when there's an offer on the table, sometimes you have to take it and do what's in the best interest of your shareholders, and unfortunately not in the best interest of you and your employees and sort of their long-term career paths. And so, you know, that I do wish that we had built something longer lasting and everlasting and something that was self-sustaining for the next 50 years, and that I would have had some lifers that worked with me there. That didn't happen with this company. Maybe in the future there will be a company that I'll start that I get to do something like that. But, you know, the one thing I did want out of all of this was that, you know, the crossover name stayed on and that the product lived on, and that, you know, if I ever have kids 15, 20 years from now and they're playing high school ball, I would love for their school to have crossover and, you know, for me to be able to say, yo, we built that thing that you're using now. And I felt like, you know, there would have been other opportunities to sell to a competitor, for example, where they would have definitely shut our product down and killed it and just taken our customers and put them on their own platform. And to me, that would have been an even shittier outcome than sort of having to sell to private equity and having, you know, watching them kind of lay off a lot of people and restructure things and change the way we do things. That just having the whole product shut down would have been, I don't know if I could have handled that. That would have really been disappointing to me.
Yeah, I could see that completely. I think one of the things that, if you're an entrepreneur or a business owner, I think one of the things is that's difficult is to, especially as you grow it yourself, is to just being able to, first of all, let go from some of the things that, you know, especially if you started up as one person or, you know, a small group of people, and suddenly as it grows, you're no longer involved in every single aspect of the business. And then to get to the stage where you got to, where now all of a sudden, not only are you not hands-on in every little aspect of the company, but now the company is no longer yours and you can't run it and have control over it. I can't even imagine what that would feel like, just from a standpoint of sitting back and watching and going, oh, that, you know, to your point, I would have done it differently. Or I, you know, I hope that the product continues on, and to see it completely disappear. Had it done that, I can see where that would have been totally, totally disappointing for you. So at least it's still out there, and you know, you can look back on it with pride and know that you had something to do with that product continuing to be on the market and continuing to be able to provide benefit to coaches and kind of still sustain the original vision that you had for it back when you started it. As you were going into that process of selling, did you have in mind what you wanted to do next, or were you just kind of still, I don't know, still looking backwards, or were you looking forwards right from the beginning?
Well, the fund had already gotten started. So we launched the fund 18 months before we sold the business. And so I was already splitting my time 50-50. You know, that was another sort of reason, when the deal came along to sell the business, I felt like, hey, I was already kind of doing something else. Not that I was not fully vested in my company, but it was sort of, for me, it was therapeutic to be able to do something different for a while. I'd done only one thing for 8 years, and I felt like running the fund on the side kind of gave me that outlet to do something different than focus on my own business every day. So I personally felt it was a very good thing for me to have this other thing. But obviously, when you have investors and other stakeholders, they're sort of looking at you going, dude, what are you doing? Like, you're doing two things. You're not fully focused on either of these jobs. And yeah, I still remember one of Dan Gilbert's people telling me a couple of days before we officially launched the fund, hey man, just warning you that you still have a chance to back out of this and keep running your company, because if things go south on either the company front or on the fund front, you know, everyone's going to point their finger at you and say, hey, Vasu was distracted. He wasn't focused on one thing, and that's why things got messed up. And so Yeah, that was sort of weighing on me as I went into this. But again, as a 29-year-old kid being given an opportunity to run a fund for a billionaire and run your own company, like it's stuff that you don't pass up. And so I said, you know what, man, we'll see what happens. If we'll cross that bridge when we get to it. Let's go full steam ahead. And I hired my partner at the fund, and the two of us basically got started. And then the day we sold the company, I essentially was able to transition full time over to the fund at that point. And you know, for the last 18 months now, we've been pretty much full time focused on investing.
So what's your process for determining what is a good investment for Courtside Ventures?
Well, it's at the early stage, you know, a lot of it's a crapshoot. It's you have no idea. It's two guys with an idea and they're sitting in a basement somewhere writing code, and you've got to come in and figure out whether you think this thing's going to be worth hundreds of millions of dollars one day for you to be able to write a $500,000 check to them now. And so I think a lot of it is pattern recognition. You're not born with this ability to sniff out winners. Anyone who says they are is full of shit. They're lucky. They might be lucky, but they're full of shit. I think as we've made so many mistakes along the way, and every time you write a bad check, you learn something from it. And the fact that you just lost $500,000. It's something that you got to keep looking at, keep trying to figure out what was it about this deal that we would have done differently. What would have told us that we shouldn't have written this check? And I think that every year that we go through this, we'll get better and better at our jobs. The more companies you see, the more stories you hear, the more you kind of are able to sniff people out to be bullshitters versus the guys that actually have something. And then a lot of it is, you know, understanding the industry, understanding customers, knowing what the market potential for something is. At the end of the day, there's lots of great businesses that will be built, but they don't all require venture capital money. And that's the key. It's sometimes hard, especially as a passionate basketball guy, when I hear a basketball pitch for something, I'm sitting there going, man, I would love to have had this when I was growing up. Or I would love to use this today, but I have to remember that like there's only so many hardcore dudes like me that doesn't make for a massive business. And so it's a lot of separating, hey, this is a good idea from, hey, this is a big idea, because it's the big ideas that we as venture capitalists have to fund, because the way the economics work out in a fund, you know, 33% of our investments we expect to fully fail. Like we're going to lose every dollar that we put into that. So out of a, you know, $35 million fund, 10 million bucks straight up gone. The next 10 million we think are just going to break even. So that 10 is just going to give 10 back to us. And so it's the last 10 million bucks that we invest that we kind of have to turn into 100. And so those last 10 guys need to be 10 timers at the very least. And it's unlikely that all 10 of those are going to be 10 timers. What you really end up getting is like two or three of them that end up being 50 timers, and everyone else is kind of a dud. It's not really a dud. Like there's guys that are pouring their heart and soul into those companies and they build something amazing. But for us as investors, those end up being duds if they don't generate many, many times our money back. And so, you know, sometimes half my job, I'd say, is in these pitch meetings, me trying to tell a founder from my standpoint as someone who built a company, raised capital, did all of it. I'm saying, hey, man, listen, you've got a great idea here. I don't think you're going to build a $100 million company, but I think you can build a company that's going to generate like $5 to $10 million a year. And if you own the whole thing, you're going to make more money putting that profit in your pocket than you trying to swing for the fences here, raise a bunch of money, and then 3 years from now, you're dead and you don't make anything. And trying to get that across, which is not technically my job as an investor. I'm not supposed to be telling people not to take money from us, but I find that half the time that's what I end up doing is telling founders not to take money.
How open are people to that advice? I mean, when you're sitting in that pitch meeting and they're talking to you and you're listening to their idea and you like their idea, but in your heart of hearts, you know that it's not a $100 million idea. And then you share that with them. How open are people to hearing that? I'm sure it varies, but just generally speaking.
Yeah, I can't remember anyone sort of, you know, outright telling me I'm crazy or that I'm an idiot or whatever. Like that, I think everyone just takes it, but I think they take it with a grain of salt. And I tell them to take it with a grain of salt, because every time I say something like this to them, I also say, listen, guys, I'm a data point of one. I could be wrong. I have been wrong many times in my life. But here's what I'm telling you as a guy that hears about 2,000 pitches a year, has built one of the only companies in this industry that raised capital and sold, and is someone who for the last 10 years of my life have been following this space very, very closely. I could be wrong, but if you're playing the odds, I'm probably right. And if I'm telling you this, you know, take it to heart. And you know, many times I don't know what the founders end up doing, right? Like, we have this conversation and they understand that based on that, I'm not going to give them money. And then they go off and do their own thing. I think, you know, some of them have probably taken my advice and have kind of bootstrapped this thing and tried to build a sustainable business. I'm sure other people have just continued to pitch and pitch and pitch. And, you know, there's always an idiot on this earth who will give you money. I truly believe that no matter how terrible your idea, if you're willing to knock on 1,000 doors, there is some rich guy out there that is going to think you have a great idea. He's going to give you money. So there's something to be said for sticking with it. But I think there's also something to be said for listening to the advice of people that have seen this stuff before and kind of trying to build something sustainable versus trying to build, you know, something that you have to sell. Again, going back to my own story, if I could do things differently, I would have gotten out of New York, where you can't build a sustainable company very easily given the cost of living. And as a result, you're raising money. And once you raise money, you can't build a sustainable business. You need to build a big business that you think you can swing for the fences and make everyone a ton of cash. And so, you know, that's the path we ended up taking, and it resulted in us having to sell the company at some point. And, you know, a lot of my people having to move on to other jobs that I truly feel would have stayed on forever with us. And so I think the last 10 to 15 years, the amount of capital flowing into venture capital funds, and again, I shouldn't be saying all this because I'm a venture guy, but I really feel like the amount of money that's flowing out there is kind of putting, it's painting raising money in a very different light. And many businesses need that. If you're going to build the next Uber, yes, Uber needed to raise $20 billion to become one of the largest companies on earth and change transportation forever. But like 99% of ideas out there are not big enough to be Uber. And a lot of those, I think, would benefit from founders living in cities where the cost of living is low. You can bootstrap things. You can raise very little money from friends and family, and you can get something off the ground. You can get it to profitability, and you just keep growing. And you know, I think that other than the super, super rich people out there who have built massive companies that have sold, most of America's millionaires are people that have a small business, and they are profitable, and they keep plowing their profits back into the business. And it grows slowly over many, many decades, but it's something that you can pass on from generation to generation. And it's something that you can say you built to last versus sort of what the flavor of the week today seems to be, which is, hey, how quickly can I spend venture money on marketing dollars to grow my user base and hope that someone buys me before we run out of cash?
I think that's people only see the stars. They don't see all the people that have shot for the stars and then ended up not making it to that level. And so I think that's where you see the disconnect between what you just described as somebody starting a sustainable business that, you know, doesn't reach those stratospheric levels, but instead is something that is sustainable and something that they can continue to work at and work in year after year after year, make a profit, make a comfortable living, and then pass it on to their kids or whatever the case might be. But everybody, especially when you're in your 20s, I think people want to shoot for, you know, that huge shot. And a lot of times that ends up, you know, being something that doesn't work out the way that it did for you or for some other people that, you know, that just didn't get to those levels. When you're looking at somebody who makes a pitch and you're trying to decide, okay, you're getting close to making that decision, how much do you weigh in that person's – how much do you weigh the person versus the idea when it comes down to whether you're going to put your money into a particular investment or with a particular – you know, with a particular founder?
You know, we say – in the early stages that it's all about the founder, not so much about the idea. In a perfect world, I would love to say that that's what we do. I don't think any VC really gets to that point where they're completely willing to overlook the concept itself and just back a guy or a girl because they really believe in them. We've done that. There have been times where we didn't really understand much about what they were building, or it was a little too technical for us, or it was something that we just didn't necessarily believe in from an idea standpoint, but we said, you know what, this founder is just phenomenal, and we think that they'll figure it out one way or another. If this idea doesn't work, they'll pivot and they'll figure it out. And so sometimes we have written checks to back founders that it didn't matter what they were building. But I don't think that you can really just do that all of the time. I think there's definitely something to be said, especially when you're a vertically focused fund like us, where we only focus on an industry that we know very, very well. It allows us to kind of pick apart the concept and really challenge the entrepreneur on the things that we know about the industry and say, hey, listen, you think you're going to get X dollars from every team for this, but like, we're telling you, there's no way you're going to get that. And now if you look at your projections, this doesn't make sense anymore. And so I think when you're a generalist VC investing in only the biggest ideas, it doesn't matter what industry, what have you. I think there's VCs out there that just go around trying to find the most talented founders and they back them. And I think that is a strategy that will win if you can invest in anything and everyone on earth. But when you're sort of hold into sports like we are, I don't think that we can only back just the best founders. We do kind of have to look at the idea and look at the market size and look at the opportunity and the competition and look at all of those things as we make a decision on whether we would invest or not.
So what are a couple of investments that you have right now? Can you share one or two things that you have out there going right now that are particularly exciting that you're, really optimistic about the future of the companies?
Yes, so there's a company called The Athletic, I'd say, which I'm sure you guys have all heard of. They've become the hottest sports media site in the country. This is a company that was started just under 2 years ago, or maybe a little over 2 years ago now, and they've grown leaps and bounds. They just raised a $40 million round from one of the best Silicon Valley VCs, and they've just changed the sports journalism game. They truly believe that if you write good content or you create good content, that people will pay for it. And it's not a novel idea. There's nothing about what they did that was novel. I think it was a combination of timing, a point where sort of ad-based journalism was struggling. Big media companies were laying off sports writers and all these talented people were looking for something to do and somewhere to go. And along comes The Athletic that said, hey, listen, guys, stop writing clickbait. You come to The Athletic, you get to write the stories that you want to write, that the passionate fans want to read, and they'll pay $6 a month for it. Again, nothing at all novel about it, but they executed so well. And then as is with most things in life, timing is everything. And so I think the timing, the execution, the founders came from another consumer-focused sports company called Strava. So everything kind of lined up, and we were, essentially almost the first money into that company 2.5 years ago, and have continued to support them in every round that they raised. And they're on their way to potentially being a $1 billion company. If they do that, I mean, they'll be one of the first sort of subscription sports businesses to actually reach that kind of evaluation. And again, fingers crossed, a lot of things can go wrong along the way, but that's probably one that we're super excited about their growth. We also invest in a company called the Drone Racing League, which you guys may have seen on ESPN a couple times. Really great founder that came from Tough Mudder. He executed really well over there. And then he decided to start this company. And I still remember when we first invested, I was going, drone racing. Like, I don't know, man. I don't know if this is going to be a thing. But, it was one of those, hey, look, it's a novel concept. The founder's incredible. They've got some big names around them. Let's take a shot on this thing. And those guys have just They've done an unbelievable job of executing and putting on races and creating content and getting media rights deals with ESPNs and other media properties in Europe. And they're expanding globally very, very quickly. So, you know, who knew drone racing would be a thing? But these guys figured it out, and they made something out of nothing. So, you know, those are probably two that I'm really excited about. StockX, another company that Dan Gilbert's involved in that we were early investors in based in Detroit, changing sort of the game when it comes to buying and selling sneakers. You know, that's a company that's just, again, a rocket ship. What they've done in just over 2 years is absolutely phenomenal. And they're employing hundreds of people now in Detroit and around the country, and they're selling just an astronomical number of shoes on a daily basis. So, you know, those three, I'd say right now, are the ones that have sort of gotten to the point where it's not that they can't fail, but it's highly unlikely that they will fail, and they'll probably all end up being very, very good outcomes. There's probably another 10 or 15 companies that are still in year one of their life. We've just written a seed stage check into them. You know, the sky's the limit, but it's too early to tell what's going to happen with them. But there's a lot of interesting things that we've invested in, and we're very excited to see how those pan out over the next 5 to 10 years.
Yeah, it's got to be exciting to get in on the ground floor of some of those, you know, new opportunities and ideas and things that, you know, you just see creative, smart, ambitious people doing things that, again, other people just haven't thought of. And to be able to get on the ground floor of that and see the growth of those businesses has got to be tremendously exciting. Now, I want to leave the business world, and I want to ask you a very important question. Make the case here for why Michael Jordan is the greatest basketball player in the history of the NBA.
I mean, I feel like nobody should have to even make a case. If you lived in the 90s, if you were old enough in the 90s to watch basketball, I don't think anyone, I don't know anybody who lived in that era that doesn't just immediately say and agree with the fact that Jordan is the greatest of all time. But I think I get it. If you were too young then, and then you grew up watching Kobe, and then you watch LeBron, and now you're watching Steph, I get it. I even wrote this little piece a couple years ago, and Steph was having that incredible season, and the day that he bombed that 35 or 40 footer against Oklahoma City,
that was a Saturday night game.
Yep. On ESPN, I remember just jumping out of my sofa and laughing because I knew that shot was going in when he put it up from 40 feet. It made no sense, but like, you just knew that shot was going in that night. And I think everybody in the stadium knew that shot was going in, and it went in. And you know, I wrote this piece saying, I swore I would go to my grave saying that Michael Jordan's the greatest basketball player who ever lived and ever will live. But tonight I'm starting to question whether it's possible that there may one day be someone who's better than Jordan because of what I'm seeing Steph do. And look, I think I certainly got very heated in the moment. And, you know, I step back a couple years later, I'll say, look, Steph's not Jordan. Steph's nowhere close to being Jordan. I think
I'm sitting here cringing, by the way, just so you know.
Coach Jason's going to come through the microphone here at you.
I'm sure. And listen, I never said that he was better. I simply said that I was open to the idea that someone may be better than Jordan one day. Before that step shot, I had completely closed the door. And I had said, there's no way anyone will ever be better than Jordan. And I think what LeBron has done has been close. I think the number of finals trips is ridiculous. But you go back to the 90s, more physical game, no value being placed on the three-point shot like today, no analytics, no nutrition, none of this shit. Like, Jordan was probably out doing cocaine and strippers.
Well, I was going to say, they were smoking at halftime.
That's exactly right. Jordan may have been smoking cigars at halftime, and then he's coming out and killing you.
I think at halftime he was probably playing poker or something.
No, he was probably him and Tim Grover were probably a little bit ahead of the curve in terms of in terms of training. But I think if you obviously if you look at it compared to what players have access to today in terms of knowledge, there was, you know, it was like Jordan was in his garage with the, you know, with the free weights, you know, working out, as opposed to what guys have today.
You know, little known fact, Tim Grover is an Indian, by the way. Did you guys know that?
I did not know that.
Tim Grover is 100% Indian. His actual name is Tim Singh Grover. Please fact check me. An Indian is behind the greatest basketball player on earth.
All right. I like it. Here's my argument for Jordan. My argument for Jordan is that whenever I watched him play, it kind of goes to your same argument that you were debating when you watched the Steph shot go in. And that is that whenever I watched him play, I never doubted that he was going to find a way to win the game. And that could have been, I never doubted whether he'd make the last shot. I never doubted when the Bulls were down 10 with 4 minutes to go. I never doubted when another team was better than him. I never doubted when some other player, you know, rose up to challenge him, that he was going to meet that challenge. And I just never, ever, ever doubted it. I've never felt that way about anybody else in any other sport. And that's not to say that he won every time, because obviously he did. But I never felt that way about anybody else in sports. And to me, that makes him the greatest.
Yeah, I think you summed it up real nicely. I agree with that sentiment. That's the one thing I remember. And I was quite young, by the way, when Michael was at his prime. I was still, you know, call it 7 years old, 7-8 years old. And so I only remember bits and pieces of it, but I still have that same feeling today, being 8-9 years old. Like, I was the kid that would cry when the Bulls lost, and thankfully the Bulls didn't lose very much, but like, I was obsessed with Jordan and the Bulls as an 8-year-old kid who doesn't know anything about the world. And I still to this day understand what you're talking about, and that feeling that I never thought he would let them fail. And you know, when I watch other sports today, you know, the closest I will say in terms of, you know, the artistry and the, you know, that they'll somehow pull through, you've got Federer, you've got Serena, you've got Messi, you've got all these guys, but even with them, I say it's more, you look at them and you say what they're doing is incredible. It's the most beautiful thing. It's a symphony. It's an orchestra watching these people play sports, but it's not, I don't think they'll ever lose. But that was the one thing with Michael, is you never thought he would lose. And he, you know, for the most part, I do think that if he hadn't retired, they would have won 8 straight. But you know, everyone asked me the question, well, the Bulls, the 96 Bulls or the 97 Bulls or the Warriors from, you know, this era. And I never want to bet against Michael. And so I always say to them, I say, look, if you tell me that you're going to bring that team of Bulls and you're going to bring this team of Warriors and they're going to play basketball of one of the eras, I don't care which era it is, whether it's 90s era basketball or today's era basketball. And if you say it's today's era, that means that you're telling me Michael and Scotty and these guys are shooting threes the way the Warriors can. I still say no one's going to beat Michael Jordan, because that X factor, he will find a way to win. But I have to put an asterisk and say, look, if you talk about the way they're playing basketball today with a three-point game, I just don't know if a Warrior team would just shoot them out of the gym and be able to put up. I mean, these guys are putting up 130, 140 points a night with ease. And the Bulls, you know, they'd be winning the NBA championships 84-86.
Yeah, I think there's
– that I worry.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think the what you'd have to do is, if you were to project Jordan forward, obviously if he grew up in the era of the game today, he would be in the gym maniacally working on his three-pointer with the understanding that it's a totally important part of the game. And at that time, it wasn't looked upon the same way that it is today. So he didn't need it in his repertoire per se. And so I think if you project that team, if you take the Bulls and you put them in to the 2019 NBA, all those guys have just developed a different sort of skill set that would enable them to compete. And I think, to your point, again, if it comes down to a it comes down to a battle of wills, and I just don't think Jordan is losing that battle of wills. He's going to do what it takes to beat people. And I just, people continue to try to make the argument for other guys, and obviously we're here in Cleveland, so there's a lot of sentiment for LeBron being the greatest ever. And I still, you know, I've watched LeBron for whatever 15 years and never felt the same degree of confidence that LeBron was going to come through in the biggest moments.
I just want to, we were talking last night, we did a pod last night about like the MVP last season, like if we could retroactively go back and take it away from James Harden and give it to LeBron, because he took that corpse of a Cavs team to the finals. And that's the only argument that I see for LeBron, is he took a team last year to the finals that this year the whole shell came back and they were 0-8 and like the dredges of the NBA. And that might be his greatest argument. And that's kind of, I know you can't really use that argument, but that might be his greatest argument, is I took these teams that were terrible to the playoffs and to the finals, not to mention that part.
I totally agree with that. I will say I've never been a LeBron fan, but last year was the first time that down the stretch of the season and into the playoffs, I started to get the sense that he wasn't going to let them lose. And I felt like his shot was better last year than I've ever seen it. And every time he shot the ball, I thought that ball's going in. The way I feel when Steph's shooting the ball, the way I felt when Michael was shooting the ball, and I got to watch a decent amount of him last year. I went up to Boston for game 7 of the Western Conference Finals, and watching LeBron bring that one home, it was the closest I've felt to that feeling of, you know, this guy is not going to let them lose. That said, I knew the minute that series was over, like, this is it. Like,
it's, yeah, the next series was over, right? Exactly. The next series was over before it started.
Listen, it was over the second J.R. Smith didn't know the score. And that's all I'm going to say.
It was over before that. It was definitely over before that. So I feel fortunate. I feel fortunate we got one. You know, I don't know that anybody here in Cleveland, as a lifelong Clevelander, I don't know that I thought we were ever going to get any. So I'm very happy that we were able to get one from, you know, from the Warriors out of that 4-year stretch. And if Durant doesn't go to the Warriors, who knows? Maybe we got a shot at another one or two. But it's been a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun to have LeBron here in Cleveland, be able to watch great basketball.
And we're looking forward to Zion next year.
Yeah, we're looking forward to getting Zion here next year. We get the number one pick. So that's the plan. Dan Gilbert, he's going to send Nick to the lottery, and we're going to win whatever our fifth lottery in 15 years, whatever it is.
That's all we need. We just need Nick to be there. And
that's what I'm hoping. I'm hoping Dan has, you know, whatever magic he's cooked up in the past, I hope he cooks it up again, because I would love to watch Zion dunk here in Cleveland for the next 10 years.
No doubt.
He's phenomenal. Vasu, this has been tremendous. We really appreciate you jumping on and spending an hour with us tonight. If you wouldn't mind, before we get out of here, share out some contact information, how people can check you out and see what you're doing. And then if you have anything that we didn't hit on that you want to share before we get out, go ahead and do that now as well.
Yeah, I mean, if you want to see my incessant NBA tweets and my yelling at Trump tweets, then you can follow me on Twitter at Vasu, VASU. If you want to watch my daily Instagram highlights from my pickup basketball run, you follow me on Instagram at VBK23. And otherwise, we're at courtsidevc.com. If you're building a company in sports, esports, media, you know, hit us up. We're always looking for the next big thing.
Awesome. Vasu, we can't thank you enough for jumping on with us tonight. And to everyone out there, we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks.
Head Start Basketball's Player Development Academy offers Cleveland area players a unique opportunity to improve their basketball skills. Regardless of a player's age, skill level, or position, training with Head Start Basketball will elevate your game to the next level. Do you want to improve your ball handling, become a better shooter, or develop into a more skilled, confident player? Our academy classes offer training that's designed to do just that. Our training sessions are innovative and will have you learning skills that are transferable to actual games. We have 4 different class skill levels for boys and girls, ages 4 and up. All Player Development Academy classes will be held at the Strongsville Recreation Center. For more information or to get registered,
please visit www.headstartbasketball.com.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads podcast, brought to you by Head Start Basketball.